the dual pole polarized downlink signal to the DSN that could almost double the downlink rate. Initial tests with the Deep Space Network in this dual polarized mode have been successful. So there you go. In an effort to make the Deep Space Network polarization combining technique, operation was underway. See, they have circular polarization, one's right hand and one's left handed, so I guess that's what's going on there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, up to now I was considering techniques of combining the power before going to the transmitting antenna, or having two separate antennas, but with that category, that's not so easy. However, if you've got one traveling wave tube going to a horizontal element on the antenna, the feed horn, and the other traveling wave tube going to a vertical element, feed either one all by itself and you're linear polarized. Feed both simultaneously with 90 degrees of phase shift, and now you're generating circular polarization. Therefore, as long as Goldstone knows that today they're looking for linear horizontal or linear vertical, and tomorrow you're looking for clockwise circular polarization, as long as you configure the Goldstone receiving antenna, configure the Goldstone receiving antenna the right way, now if either transmitter fails, you're only down 3 dB in power, not 6, because the real combining is taking place at the Goldstone receiving antenna. Very crafty. That's what I think you're telling me. So I think one traveling wave tube at a time, you're linear polarized. Both of them at the same time, you're circular polarized. That's if both tubes are running on the exact same frequency. Another approach would be one tube is feeding a clockwise generator. Another tube is feeding a counterclockwise generator on a slightly different frequency. Now you've got two independent downlink channels. So there's a lot of ways you could go here where now the graceful degradation, if you lose a tube, is you're down 3 dB, not 6 dB. Did they give you any of those details as to how they did that, Paul? When they use one tube at a time, is it still circular? Or is it linear? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
WS2N, well, what I read was it's circular. You know, just use them one at a time. So, that's the way they wrote it up. And to get any further information on this is going to be difficult. I searched for Voyager, I couldn't find it, but in searching, I wound up with the story about New Horizon. You go from one website to the other. Wikipedia actually had something on it, and then from there you wind up on these government sites and these they look like university sites that have detailed information, PDF files. And this is not stuff that normally makes the news, I'll tell you that thing. But no, that's about all I got on it.
Well, we're still making progress. We're finding out a lot about this thing. And there are a couple of very fancy amateurs scattered around the world, the microwave guys, who like listening to these spacecraft with their backyard equipment. Now, because their backyard equipment is so many decibels lower in gain than Goldstone, these guys are not getting a signal strong enough above threshold that they're receiving the data, but they are receiving the carrier. Some of these Mars spacecraft, a couple of these microwave enthusiasts, did hear the carrier of a NASA spacecraft on the way to Mars. A little bit similar to some of the work that I did at one time, listening to the Apollo astronauts. I managed to get enough signal strength to get astronaut audio when they were on the high-gain downlink antenna. Let me drop. but the command service module also had a low gain antenna, which had a nearly omnidirectional pattern, so no matter how the spacecraft is oriented, you can still talk to that antenna. Goldstone could get audio out of that one. I could not. So I am curious as to whether or not, if New Horizons, if one traveling wave tube is clockwise and one traveling wave tube is counterclockwise, you'd probably have to use that on different frequencies, because one of the crazy characteristics of circular polarization is that if I've got a clockwise generator and a counterclockwise generator on the exact same frequency, and space will combine the two, a clockwise signal and a counterclockwise signal combines to be linear, which is not bad, as long as Goldstone knows which linear to listen to. The nice thing about clockwise is the spacecraft could slowly be rotating, and you don't have to worry about the polarization of the downlink signal. Whereas if they did feed linear, and the spacecraft is rotating in order to get the gyroscopic stabilization, then you've got to be rotating your linear feed horn probe on Goldstone's dish in order to listen to that signal. So we're not quite sure what they're doing here yet, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I can't even confirm the band. I thought I read X on one website, another one KU. I can't confirm the band. Never mind the frequencies. How they gonna do that? I'm sure they'll have the same system with the being able to tell the distance with New Horizon. Same thing that they had with Voyager. You know, the signal going up is gonna determine everything. You know, don't forget this thing's gonna leave the solar system as well. Go out to the heliosphere, and they need to have all this accurate information. It's going to be the fifth spacecraft to leave the solar system, that, you know, from Earth. Two Pioneers, two Voyages, and now New Horizons. But before it does, if it leaves Pluto, they're going to send it on to at least one, possibly two, Kuiper Belt objects once they figure out which ones they're they'd like to go visit, you know, which one is more the opportunistic time, they'll send it to that location. But interesting fact about this New Horizon, I might have mentioned it in the past, and that's, I don't know, but, you know, your normal Apollo spacecraft took about 3 days to get to the moon, three and a half days. You've got other flights such as the LIDI mission. It took about a month to actually get out of the moon. It just took a lot of long elliptical orbits around the Earth until it got out to the moon and eventually got sucked up into the moon gravity well, and they put that into orbit that way. That took about a month. But New Horizons blasted out of here so fast with the Atlas 551. That means it had five boosters attached to it, most of it. That the time frame to get to the lunar orbit, naturally, the moon's out of the way at the time, but to get to the equivalent of that orbit, roughly a quarter of a million miles out, took 9 hours. 9 hours past the lunar orbit. That thing was really moving. K2RIW, WS2X.
9 hours, which is, let me think, 12 hours would be half a day. 9 hours is what, a third of a day? Yeah, little less than a third of a day. Wow. As opposed to 3 days. Almost a 10-to-1 difference. There is another catch here, though. The Apollo astronauts, even if they had more capability, they wanted to go into lunar orbit, not just whiz by the moon, so that even if you had the ability to launch with more speed, you wouldn't want to use it. unless you were willing to use a whole lot of braking as you get approach to the moon in order to get it into orbit. So it would take a hell of a lot more fuel to do that. Let me drop. Now, you said something else that's darn interesting, and that is you believe New Horizons has X-band and maybe Ka-band. And if that's true, is one traveling wave tube set up for X-band and one traveling wave tube set up for Ka-band? That's one possibility. There's a slim possibility that with a good traveling wave tube design, because they're so broadband, it is possible the traveling wave tube, each one of them, can take a signal on X-band and amplify it, or a signal on Ka-band and amplify it. That's possible. I think the first is more likely. One tube is on K-band, and one K-tube is on X-band. Did you get any hints along those lines, Paul? And by the way, the dish itself, to make the dish work simultaneously on K-band and X-band is very easy. The dish itself is broadband as all hell. You put the right kind of a broadband feed horn into the dish, and it'll work on all the frequencies you want. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that with a Cassegrain system, to have the main feed horn feeding the subreflector, and that's the high gain mode, and to have another dish on the backside of the subreflector as a low gain mode, and that second dish doesn't create a shadow on the first dish because it's really in the exact same place where the subreflector is, where you already had a shadow. So there have been a number of spacecraft antennas. Low-gain antenna is a small dish on the backside of the subreflector, and the main feed horn feeding the subreflector is the high-gain mode. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was thinking some kind of a shadow would be caused by the system, but I don't know. That's about all the information I have on it, Dick. I was happy to find something out about the traveling wave tubes, but we'll look further into it, see exactly what bands, maybe what frequencies they're on. We got time, year and a half, for this final flyby. Too bad they couldn't have set something into orbit, but it would not have been as big a spacecraft, and that would have slowed things down. In fact, that's one of the reasons. A couple of reasons they went with that system, not to have the gimbaled system, to have everything moving, would have complicated the mission. It would have added weight. And this thing is very light, only probably 1,000 pounds, so it's really a very light spacecraft. Thank you.
Yeah, the most recent spacecraft that went into orbit around Saturn, I've forgotten the name of it, you'll tell me. I think when it did its burn, in order to slow down and to get into orbit around Saturn, that was a real long burn, like, was it like 20 solid minutes or 40 solid minutes, something like that? Over to you on that one, Paul.
Yeah, that was Cassini in 2004 when it went into orbit. And, yeah, 40 some odd minutes for that burn, that was a long burn. And, you know, this thing was coming in probably at 80,000 miles an hour. They had to slow itself down. There's been spacecraft that have gone faster, but it doesn't really count. They were close to the sun, and according to the sun's gravity well. But, I mean, the Cassini was really hauling. It needed to slow down to put itself in that orbit. And they went right between one of the rings and all. That was really something.
Now, you did mention, with reference to New Horizons, X-band and Ka-band or Ku-band. The fact that they mentioned somewhere Ka-band does suggest it has the ability to transmit or receive Ka-band, which I think is around 25 gigs. Is that roughly true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I don't know the bands. I always mix them up. I had a chart one time, all the K's and the KA's. But I'm pretty sure X-band is the main one, and somebody else wrote an article, and I'm not I'm not going to swear by that one. I think it's more like the X-band.
Okay, so have you seen anything slightly authoritative? Somebody else's article, or NASA, or JPL, or whatever, Goddard, saying anything but X-band capability on New Horizons. Over to you, Rob Hall.
Yeah, that's why I can't confirm that. There was one article, and somebody was just writing about it, and I think they fouled up. Because I've seen a couple of X-band stories. And by the way, yeah, I know, at least I remember what the X-band is. What, that's 10 gigahertz, 10.386, right, Dick? That's magic numbers.
10.368 is the 72nd harmonic of 144 megs. Ham radio-wise, 10.368. The ham's own, so to speak, 10.0 to 10.5. And 10.368 is what the hams use. NASA doesn't use that. NASA's X-band is around 8.5 gigs. See, X-band goes from 8 gigs to 12 gigs. So the lower end of X-band is 8.5, and NASA uses that. I don't think NASA uses 10 gigs per se, even though they call it X-band. Go ahead.
Ah, very good. Okay. Very good. Now I got it. Okay, 3, 6, 8. I know there was a 3, a 6, and an 8. But I reversed the 8 and 6. Okay, so they're down at a lower frequency. Very good. We'll have to look further into it. I forget even what Voyager was. I'm assuming that was probably X-band as well, I think.
I made another crazy calculation this week, and that is, I like these scale models in order to figure out what's going on. At the time that Spirit, Opportunity, or Curiosity got to Mars, Mars was in the vicinity of 300 million miles away from Earth, almost on the opposite side of the solar system. And if you made a scale model of that, Mars is very close to half the diameter of Earth, and the two things that are a 2-to-1 ratio is a 50-cent piece and a dime. 50-cent piece represents the Earth, and the dime represents Mars. And so the beautiful navigating capability of NASA was, they launched a spacecraft from the 50-cent piece, so to speak, and landed on the right letter on the dime 1 mile away. On that scale model, 50-cent piece and a dime, you put them 1 mile away during the landing. Okay. In that exact same model, if you figure out where Voyager is at roughly 120 astronomical units away, on that scale model, Voyager would be 25 miles away. So on my scale model, a 50-cent piece for Earth, which is roughly a 1,000,000,000 to 1 ratio in real sizes, 1 mile away is Mars, 25 miles away is Voyager. Voyager's really out there, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, now I got to do the math and figure out where Alpha Centauri is. I think that's 40,000 AU or something like that. I'm trying to remember. I know it's 4.5, something like 4.5 light years. But, if it's 40, I think it's 40,000 AU. Forget the number. But, wow, where would that be? I think that would be in outer space somewhere.
Well, it's going to be a long way out. And by the way, I've got a calculator that will convert the astronomical units and light years. And maybe I'll do that before we sign off tonight. Okay, the space stuff, I think it's going to catch on, Paul. I think it's not just a flash in the pan. I found an extremely well-done article that goes on. It's a YouTube video that goes on for 1 hour that was done by Neil deGrasse Tyson, in which he describes to a particular commercial group of guys who do investing, I gave a one-hour lecture on what, when you make an investment into NASA, what you get in return. Right now, we're investing in NASA half a penny per dollar. Half a penny per dollar on our taxes, so to speak, is what goes into NASA right now. We dropped. And he went through the mathematics that if every dollar of national budget, if we spent a penny on NASA, what would we get in return? If we doubled our NASA budget because of the number of people it puts to work, the number of subcontractors it puts to work, the number of breakthroughs you make, the number of fallout pieces of hardware you get out of it, when it comes to the progress for the future, when it comes to, he's making a point that we think we're going to control outsourcing by putting tariff on things. Let me drop. The whole reason
for the worst for the Apollo mission, Dick, do you remember?
The hold on Apollo mission is roughly $33 billion. Nowadays you can do it a hell of a lot cheaper. But what I'm getting at is that, forgot the point I was going to make now. It's a good one.
Outsourcing.
That's it. Let me drop. The whole reason why your various companies in the United States outsource is because you can hire Southeast Asia labor to build your hardware at one half, one third, one quarter the price. And there are times when that's a great benefit. And now you think you're going to control outsourcing by making it more expensive, by tariffing it. Well, you're fighting yourself. From Neil's point of view, the stuff that we outsource is the stuff that we have developed. No more development is required. Now you just manufacture it. And we do the outsourcing of the manufacturing. But of all the new stuff we develop, for a period of time, we manufacture it and develop it locally. We don't outsource the development per se. We only outsource the manufacturing. So if you doubled your budget to NASA, you would be doubling the amount of local development that you'd be doing, and you'd be putting a hell of a lot of people to work without outsourcing. And when it comes to your venture capitalists, they get a lot more bang for the dollar doing it that way. And so he's got a very nice YouTube video explaining all this. I guess I'm going to make sure that gets onto Bernie's website so that other people can read it or see it. When you watch that thing, boy, he makes a darn good case from my point of view. He's an exciting speaker. I bet you've seen some of his YouTube videos. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I've probably seen every one of his shows on PBS, not the YouTube videos. I haven't seen his. He's had terrific shows on PBS. Nova Science Now and all of that. And you know, when Carl Sagan died off, people, oh, who's going to replace this guy? Well, this guy is very well spoken. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he replaced him.
Absolutely. At least as well spoken, I guarantee if Johnny Carson was alive today, because he had Carl Sagan on that program, I'll bet you 35 times, he would have Neil deGrasse Tyson on his program every month, guarantee it. I guess I'm a little bit disappointed that Jay Leno hasn't done that. I think Carson was a little more space-oriented than Leno. I don't think Leno has had Neil deGrasse Tyson on very often. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Don't forget, Dick, Carson was also an astronomer, amateur.
Good point. Go ahead, Paul.
I know he's had him on, but I can't remember. It's got to be years and years since he's had Tyson on. I don't remember. So, I mean, he does get around Tyson. I mean, there's a lot of shows. He'll do cameo shows on all kinds of, you know, TV shows. He'll make an appearance playing himself.
He said he played. Blaze himself. That's a good way of putting it. But, oh, yeah, no, he's a smart guy. He's got very good ways of expressing it. And so we're not making enough use of our resources. There's capital adventurers, venture capitalists out there that are properly programmed with a real NASA project, would finance it. Doesn't even have to come from Congress, because of the fallout would give them so much bang for the dollar that it would be a darn good investment, putting a lot of people to work, doing stuff that doesn't have to be outsourced at first. And there's a lot more where that came from, so to speak. You just keep developing new stuff. And when it comes to the downrange manufacturer, you let that be outsourced. And now you get the best of both worlds. You get good development, good local labor, good return on investment. And when it comes to the manufacture of the new objects that are the fallout, they become less expensive because they're outsourced, and now everybody can afford them in theory. So he makes a good point. And I'll be bringing that one to your attention next week. Okay, let's see if anybody else listening to all this jazz has any further questions on the space subject. Well, we got Paul on channel, so to speak. Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, looks like you satisfied them all for tonight, Paul. And this week's assignment is to find out a little bit more about this X-band, Ka-band, Ku-band. That it stands to reason that the more modern spacecraft, like New Horizons, are going to be using the higher frequencies. Because free space has no loss at the higher frequencies. The exact same size dish gives you a much narrow beam width, much better aiming. You squirt more of the signal in the right direction, therefore less watts of transmit power are required in order to give you the data rate you like when you drop. And the ultimate in high frequency, of course, is laser. One last comment there, Paul. I know that you brought to our attention that one of the spacecraft, if not more than one, was using a laser transmission. I'm fairly sure that New Horizons doesn't, but which one of the spacecraft did use laser data transmission as one of the experiments, and I believe it was quite successful. WS2N, K2LAW.
That was the LOTI mission that just was launched by Orbital Science. LOTI's in orbit around the moon now. And when it first got there, one of the first, it's got a lot of instruments on board to do all the testing for the atmosphere, the very rarefied atmosphere of the moon. But one of the main things they had on there was to shoot this laser with information to Earth. In fact, White Sands in Mexico had the receiver, and it was very successful. Over seven times the amount that you would get on standard S-band. And last week I said that, let me see if I can remember what I said, if there was an HD movie that was being transmitted from the moon, on S-band, it would take 600 hours, I think I said, and then this thing would have taken like 10 minutes on the laser system. Let me drop it. In about 3 years from now, they're putting a satellite into geosynchronous orbit with the laser system, and that's going to be there permanently, not as a test, operational. That's the new high frequency thing.
Now the geosynchronous orbit laser satellite as a receiving device for spacecraft, a little bit like your TDRS satellite, beautiful. But when it comes to downlinking directly to Earth from a spacecraft, to do that at White Sands, New Mexico, where you've got the nice clear desert, dry air most of the time, pretty good. If you wanted to downlink to Goddard, where you've got foggy air quite often, the laser is not going to work so well. The good news about laser is you get a very efficient, very fast data, very sharp aiming, but for an optical signal to get through that atmosphere, It's got to be a clear, non-scintillating atmosphere with no clouds, I think. So that synchronous satellite with laser, is that receiving, transmitting? Is it TGIS-like? Well, what's the function there, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
No, it doesn't sound like the TGIS system. I think more that's like super transponder, any kind of band that goes up there, it's retransmitted by TGIS. But this is a transmitting thing from geosynchronous probably to White Sands, New Mexico. And the idea is you're going to start eventually having communications from not only the moon, but maybe Mars, or who knows where. You put something into solar orbit, helios, and, centric orbit. You start sending satellites up with this laser stuff. They want to send it, and you've got to receive it to somewhere. Like you said, you're not going to be able to send it to the Earth all the time, so they want to send it to the satellite, and then in turn eventually send it back to Earth, either, with a transmit with laser or, slower with a RF.
Okay, if a geosynchronous satellite is receiving a laser beam from some other spacecraft and then relaying it to Earth, I'm calling that a TGIS-like function. The TGIS satellites will take a space shuttle, International Space Station, Hubble, Kepler. In theory, TGIS can take any of those downlink signals, receive it at TGIS, and then downlink to the Earth, and you get a whole lot of improvement in that technique, that bent pipe technique, or you don't have to put downrange trackers like they used to do in the very early days of Mercury and Gemini. So I'm calling that a TGIS-like function. So I think you're saying the geosynchronous satellite will be receiving a laser beam from other spacecraft. Is that true, Paul? K2LIW?
Well, yeah, this will be the prototype. That's the goal. Eventually, you'll have moon bases, for instance. You'll be able to transmit directly that way. It'll always be copied by a satellite and probably retransmitted down either real time or delayed time. So the capability will be there. And the TGIS system, it would be TGIS-like in that respect. Big repeaters in the sky. And we keep saying TGIS. A lot of people don't know what we're talking about. It's been around since the 80s. TGIS is tracking data relay satellite. These are big, huge things, bigger than a couple of school buses flying around a geosynchronous orbit located in multiple places around the Earth. Every now and then they replace one. They get outdated. Well, they stop working, but there's a lot of them up there now, and Space Station uses it, all the shuttle flights use it, like I said, Hubble uses it all the time, so very efficient system. Before that, it was hit and miss. Shuttles would lose the ground station. You'd be without contact for, many minutes at a time. No more. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we pronounce it TGIS. I think the letter stands for TDRSS, Tracking Data Relay Satellite System. It's a whole bevy of satellites. In theory, there's one every 120 degrees. I think TGIS now has a full complement of either three or four satellites in orbit. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
They're going to be launching, I think it's TGIS 8. It was supposed to go at the end of this year, but I think it's going up probably, I'm thinking in February or March. I'll have to check the launch manifest. But there's been a series of them. I think they're up to 8. And then each, the latest ones are being made by Boeing. They weren't done that. They were made by somebody else years ago. might have been Lockheed, but whatever, they have different generations. They go by letters. I think this is going to be called Tetris J or something like that. You know, they have A, B, C, D, you know. So as they go along, they don't use numbers, but letters. Back to you there.
So the seventh or eighth Tetris launch, roughly how many of them are still active, if you happen to know, Paul, go ahead.
They like to have at least four, and then always one as a backup in case one fails. And they have a capability of changing location to some degree. They have problems with one. They moved it from Hawaii over to the East Coast or something. I don't know, some bizarre thing. I didn't even know they had enough fuel to do whatever they were doing. But one of them failed. But yeah, there's been a lot of them put up there. In fact, that was the payload on Challenger when Challenger blew up. That was the Tetris satellite they were going to put up there, and that was delayed a couple of years. But the earlier ones are no longer functioning. They put them into the geosynchronous graveyard. They put them up higher into space. And that's the end of that. So I think there's probably four, if not five.
Very good. When you take a satellite in orbit and attempt to change its inclination of orbit or altitude of orbit, changing altitude requires a lot of fuel. Changing inclination of orbit requires a tremendous amount of fuel. But if it's already in synchronous orbit and you just want to change its longitude, in other words, it used to be over Hawaii and now you want to move it over the East Coast, as long as you're willing to take your time getting it there, to slide it in longitude at the same altitude requires very little power. I mean, the so-called station keeping, you do a little bit of a blast every month just to stay in your 1 cubic mile window, which in order to meet your Intelsat agreement, you have to stay within a 1 mile window. You're going to stay at your location. So you're doing a burn every month or so to stay there. Well, you don't do one of those burns and you let it slide. It'll slide to the east or to the west. And as long as you're willing to take some time, it takes very little fuel to move it to a new location at the same altitude, in synchronous orbit, but just a different longitude, just over a different place. I wonder if that's ever been explained by any of the articles you've seen, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW?
No, I haven't read that. So, it just meant pumping out a bunch of fuel to move. I know changing inclination is pretty much out. Tremendous amount of power to just even go 3 degrees. I think they said if the shuttle used all their power to change the inclination, they could get about 3 degrees out of it. That's it. So that's not too good. Now these swarm satellites went up. They are going to separate, and eventually they're going to be 90 degrees apart over time. They're going to just constantly separate because they're going to push against one another or something when they've already done it. But so over time, they're going to gradually move away from one another. These things are in circular orbit about 350 miles above the Earth. And so for some reason, they're going to be able to do it, because they were set out in initially doing that. They were forced into a push against each other somehow.
And I can see how just the spring will do that. And maybe the spring is launching them, 3 meters per second away from each other. And you wait long enough, and that's going to be a lot of distance in orbit. And so a three-dimensional map of the Earth's magnetic field, including the perturbations, I guess, to the Van Allen belt by way of the solar wind. The solar wind, which is sending out those billions of pounds of, I better call it zillions of pounds of charged particles at roughly 1 million miles an hour, every so often the sun will burp and give you a great big blast of material, and that blast of material hits our Earth magnetic field and bends it around in very funny tear-shaped diagrams. You've seen those diagrams of how the Earth's magnetic field, it's the leading edge gets pushed back, the trailing edge becomes a great big long tail, and there is a sneak path by which some of those particles come back down the center of the tail and then come to the North Pole and the South Pole and make a aurora borealis or aurora australis. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yes, very good. And there was a NOVA show on not too long ago about that. And they showed just what you said, that the particles find a way between the magnetic field. They find a way back and then eventually create that borealis. So, yeah, they're going to learn a lot about that with the spacecraft. I watched the, wasn't a YouTube, it was live interviews with scientists from that were involved with this in strong accents. A little tough to get through, but I managed. And that's, you know, just like you have NASA TV, European Space Agency has, you know, ESA TV, you know, and this is what you watch, what I watch. Back to you, Bill.
Where do you go to watch ESA TV, Paul?
Well, you gotta, it's usually on during lunch. NASA's on all the time. I don't know if European Space Agency has it on all the time, because I've only put it on during their lunch. And you just bring up ESA, you gotta put space, you gotta put something in there, otherwise Google doesn't recognize it. Just put ESA, Space Agency, TV, live TV, that's what I put in, and then you'll get that, like, during a lunch. What they have during a week, I don't know if they have anything at all.
Back in the days when I was using my TVR, or television receive only terminal, I used to be able to watch NASA Select, essentially 24 hours a day, and live you could watch what the astronauts are doing from the space shuttle. My satellite dish is not operational. I got to get that back operational. I wonder, is there a website you know of that will allow you to watch NASA Select? Assuming NASA Select TV still exists, I wonder if you know about that, Paul. Go ahead.
I always thought it was what I was watching. You bring up NASA TV, and you'll see the documentaries and the things on there. And sometimes they'll have things for kids and whatever. Just bring up NASA TV. You can go to NASA.gov and then there's a choice of TV. And then once you get that, you save it to favorites. And I even get it on my tablet. Ustream carries it. For some reason, I wasn't able to get it. Something to do with Flash. I don't know. I called up and I called up the company I own the tablet with, Kindle, and they said, no, you can't put the Flash in there. I don't know. Whatever. I tried this Ustream. No problem. But not 100% of the time. So the regular computer, like if you have a PC, you should be able to get it 100% of the time. If you go to NASA TV, Dick, and beautiful pictures, I blow up that picture to full screen, watch it take off, it's great.
Well done. Okay. So it exists. And I wonder if there's anything different on the NASA Select downlink S-band signal that I used to watch, that I could watch again if I reestablished that 10-foot dish of mine. Okay. Are there people that want to discuss the so-called deeper subjects? Are they around tonight? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Quick info on the NASA Selected.
Go ahead, Paul. I mean, John.
If you go on your computer, NASA Select TV Live, that still exists.
Very glad to hear that. That used to be a lot of fun to watch during shuttle launches. During a shuttle mission that was operational 24 hours a day, and you could see live what the astronauts are doing when they're running their experiments. And they even would show you what the shuttle is doing during the time the astronauts were sleeping. There was a camera somewhere aimed at the Earth, and you saw live pictures as the shuttle was flying over the Earth, and you would see thunderstorms over South America, so to speak. Beautiful stuff. And I'm calling it live because it was, let me drop.
You just reminded me of what that program I was watching on TV was. That was about sprites on that discussion we were having the other night.
That's it. It was the sprites. Well done program. Go ahead, Wes.
I saw the sprites. I saw that show too, John. Wes, go ahead.
Not because it's only a few minutes left, but I think I have something interesting. They sent some material to John. As a Polish professor, actually he's American, who was giving a series of lectures of ability to extract precious metal from different materials. One of them is the glass used for the
beer bottle glass, getting the gold thick.
Glass containers for anything. It would be bottles whatsoever. He actually shows using a regular oven how to extract the metal out of the bottles, and that was a precious metal. And to achieve.
The reason believed that there is enough gold or silver or some other precious metal contained in the glass of currently available bottles, that the process of extracting it is a economically worthwhile thing to do. Roughly how much precious metal is contained in roughly how much glass, Wes, in 2XJN, KQIIW?
The video of Professor John Milewski, it's a part two of two. He was able to achieve quite a significant amount of metal that was flowing into the form out of approximately the same amount of primary material. John, have seen, I believe, that video, John?
Yes, I did. I saw that volume 2, and he did not get any gold. He did not melt any glass, but he did melt silver, pure silver that he had, to show that it could be melted in a microwave oven. That's all I saw. I did not see him retrieve gold, but he did show a lump of gold that he claims he retrieved from glass bottles, beer bottles usually.
Yeah, so what we're saying right now is we're not trying to make right now the economic evaluation of whether it's worth or not, but it's just an interesting subject of his study. He's an American professor, PhD of one of the universities, former Los Alamos chief of staff.
Wes, Rheingold, I think, used to sell kind of beer that they called golden lager. Does that mean that there was glass in those bottles? I'm having a little bit of fun here. Back to you, Wes, K2RIW.
That was a good one. Well, it's an interesting subject because it's not that complicated for some members of this repeater, and it's interesting.
Do you believe you and I have the hardware that could do? Wes, go ahead.
Well, he showed a very simple process.
Okay, so he did show you how to do it, and I guess you're saying it's doable maybe with a microwave oven.
Huh.
And I had seen people mount melt beer bottles in a microwave oven. I've seen YouTube videos on just that. And quite doable. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1477 of the series that began in 1982, 31 and a fraction years ago. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week, and we'll figure out how all this hardware works, it says here.
AC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. Okay, bye-bye, John. Who said something about 1961? What was that?
K2RIW, B3ZTZ, call.
B3ZTZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Scott.
Scientific American Digital Edition. 2 weeks back, published an article, or referenced an article, on Maxwell's equations, and how they demonstrated, or more recently, people working with the equations have demonstrated that the magnetic fields from Maxwell's equations can be folded, as opposed to sine wave only. And I was wondering if you'd come across that article, and if you had, had you thought into your often heard remarks here that an antenna at resonance, the signal travels back and forth many times before it jumps off into space. Is that actually what's happening, or is it a process of folding that actually occurs based on the frequency, and it has to fold before it jumps off into space?
I was waiting for the beep. When it comes to an antenna, just like any other kind of resonator, every resonator has a certain ratio of stored energy to dissipated energy per cycle. That ratio is usually called Q. Every antenna has a finite bandwidth, a finite Q, measurable Q, stored energy, and so whenever you've got stored energy in a resonator, it really is, in the case of an antenna, bouncing back and forth, because the antenna is a linear resonator. It's got length. In the case of an LC network resonator, you've got stored energy, which is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. And there it's not quite as linear with the usual arrangement. But in the case of a straight out wire like a dipole, it's linear, it's bouncing off the end, and so it is a sine wave bounce. It doesn't have to do anything square or folding. I haven't seen this article about magnetic folding, so give me a couple of words. What is magnetic folding, Scott? B3ZTZ, K2LIW?
Well, I don't have the article in front of me, but I guess to summarize it in layperson's terms, the magnetic fields, instead of being sine waves as we always image them or picture them, or you sprinkle the iron filings over a magnetic, over a magnet, and you get those nice semicircular ley lines. That magnetic field, the force field, the force of the field can be folded into very distinct shapes. And that Maxwell's equations allow for this, and more recently some scientists have demonstrated it, and captured it, and imaged it in certain ways. And they now believe that this folding is more common in our world than they previously thought, and that it may have something to do with how antennas and RF propagate.
The folding that the article is talking about, Scott, is that something you do a specific intentional function? You do something intentionally that forces folding, or when a magnetic field, a cyclic magnetic field exists in a system or circuit, automatically it's folding? So is the folding a natural phenomenon, or is it something mankind intentionally does for some beneficial reason? B3ZTZ, K2LIW.
My takeaway from the summary of the article in the Digital Digest is that it is occurring naturally, and the shapes that it forms has to do with frequency and other input, so it can be man-made. But what we're doing with it to get useful work out of it is one thing. What's actually happening at physics level is beginning to, they're starting to see something a little different than traditional thinking, and it's this folding of the fields. I'll see if I can get the link for you. I know I heard you once comment before, you're a little behind in your Scientific American digital reading from time to time, so I'll see if I can dig it out for you.
Scott, I am a subscriber for lots and lots of years of Scientific American, and I get the hard copy version. Now, many magazines like QST have a online version. I'm also a light member of QST, so I can read the online version of QST a few days earlier than the hard copy arrives at my mailbox. Is that what's going on with Scientific American? Is it an online version that's called digital? Or is there something more special about digital Scientific American? 3ZTZ, A2RIW.
I believe the link is SIAM Digital. And I get subscribed, I tick off a bunch, or once upon a time, ticked off a bunch of boxes of interest, and it sends me emails every couple of days with relevant articles. And this was an article in one of those lists. But all the articles go back to their SIAM page.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm getting that, if I checked off the right boxes. I'll have to check. Okay, folding of magnetic fields. And you probably heard my slightly radical theory of a couple of months ago that I'm convinced that the real propagation of RF is almost all magnetic. We call it an electromagnetic wave, but I don't think there's any real electronics to it in space. All you need is a changing magnetic field to sweep by your piece of wire, and by Faraday's law, it will induce a voltage in your wire. Therefore, you can think there was E fields in that free space. There doesn't have to be one. Just the changing of the magnetic field and Faraday's law will induce a voltage into your antenna. Back to you, Scott, K2RIW.
Yeah, I copy that, and I'm just trying to find the article here. So give me a minute, and maybe I'll get the link for you shortly.
Roger.
The way the Juno craft does have Ka band has to do with the gravitational experiment.
You said Juno craft. I know I'm having trouble placing Juno.
When I Googled it, that's what came back with the New Horizon Juno, and the maybe that's the name of the scientific payload on New Horizon.
Okay, so Juno is the payload on New Horizon, and run it by one more time. Juno is, I think you said, making measurement of a magnetic field.
Gravity science investigation will probe the mass properties of Jupiter by using the communication subsystem to perform Doppler tracking. Gravity science is a distributed instrument. It includes an X-band and a K-band transponders on the spacecraft and a 34-meter deep space network antenna at Goldstone, California. That's off WikiLeaks, or Wikipedia.
Did you copy the WS2N? I sure did, Paul, and you were right. You were right on target there, Paul.
I just want to correct you. He's saying Juno. The Juno is the one going to Jupiter. That's the Ka. I'm still not clear about what Horizon has.
Okay, we will find out as time goes on.
Okay, Juno is the spacecraft that's on the way to Jupiter. That'll be there in 2016, but about the instrument on the horizon as a separate spacecraft altogether.